Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. Poor scientists have a hard time with the media. Years of study, peer-reviewed articles, entire books written on a topic, and when they call up a journalist, what do they get? Yeah, that's great. Can you put it in layman's terms and keep it to less than 10 seconds, thanks, mate? And can you make it, you know, make it sexy? Well, no such problems with this next story. In fact, NIWA's own headline about this newly discovered creature reads, "New carnivorous sponge gives its prey the kiss of death." And here to discuss this newsworthy little periphera is Dr. Michelle Kelly from NIWA. So did I say it right? Periphera, is that right?
Yes, that's correct, periphera. What?
And that just means that's the class that all sponges belong to, is that right? Now, we've actually got you here. There's a couple of sponges that we want to discuss today. Now, there's a sentence that I never thought I'd say. Both are carnivorous.
That's correct.
One of them, the kiss of death one, was discovered a couple of months ago. And then this new one is top 10 species finalist. Is that quite exciting, having a sponge in the top 10 species?
Well, it is quite exciting, actually. It's quite exciting. It's, I guess, a little surprising. You know, well, to be perfectly honest, I didn't even know the top 10 competition was on. But my colleague in France, he submitted our species for this particular competition, and that's how we got into it. Yeah. Quite exciting, really.
The competition itself is intended to give science a bit more visibility, isn't it? To make it a bit more fun.
Definitely. You know, and in fact, if you were to go to the website, you'd see that the animals were very unusual. They've got some sort of unusual characteristics that make them quite interesting and neat.
Your one has been named Chondrocladia tuberformis. Did you even for a moment think about naming it after yourself?
Well, ethically, we can't really do that. And, I mean, we can name it after colleagues or say, for example, say you found a sponge and you brought it to me and I said I could name it after you. Well, that would be fine. But I can't name it after myself because it's a little...
Could you have some sort of quid pro quo deal going then where you name one of yours after a colleague and they name one of theirs after you and you sort of...
Well, you could, but we're a really modest group, us scientists.
And this is why we just don't get on with each other, the media and the scientists, isn't it, really? Far too modest.
I want to ask how you found it, because it is very small. It's maybe 1 to 2 centimetres across. How do you find these things?
Well, NIWA has an enormous program of discovery, and it sends out its vessels all over the nation, basically, through our EEZ, looking for organisms, for sponges. One of our big programs is in seamounts, so we're looking at the animals that grow on seamounts so that we can sort of look at how unique these areas are. And the kiss of death sponge came from the Macquarie Ridge, and that was actually a joint Australian voyage. What happens is all of these amazing animals are brought back to Wellington, and then the sponges are sent to me because I identify sponges. That's my profession. And so what I do is, in fact, these sponges were found several years ago, but because I'm so busy, I didn't actually get to identify them till just this year.
I've gone to visit NIWA down in Wellington before, and I'm told that there are hundreds of, if not thousands, of specimens that are yet to be identified, yet to be classified, could quite possibly be unique new species. Is that just how it is? Are you just a constant influx of brand new stuff?
Yes, it is, actually. And in fact, it's a big problem for sponges because, well, maybe they don't see it as a problem, but we see it as a problem because I'm literally the only professional sponge taxonomist in New Zealand now. There's probably 200 in the world. We have a conference coming up in September. There's only 260 people registered for it. That's an international conference. So you can see that there's a real problem in that there are, for example, I have only one person who's vaguely interested in following on from me. So one of the problems is that we have only touched the tip of the iceberg as far as inventorying the diversity of sponges. And around New Zealand, I mean, this is a worldwide problem, but speaking about New Zealand, the problem is that we just have, you know, everything that comes up from the deep ocean particularly is new. I've never seen it. What I do, I keep a record of everything I see, and as something new comes in, I compare it to what I've already seen. If it's completely new, then maybe when I get time, we get around to describing it.
So is this purely about science, or is there the potential for an economic spin-off if you find a sponge that has interesting properties?
In the case of this particular sponge, I don't think that there would be any commercial benefits because there's only one of them. I mean, in fact, we've only found six specimens, and this is the result of years and years of voyages. But over the past 20 years, I have worked with a number of marine natural products chemists around the world, and there has been tremendous economic benefit from some of those sponges that we've worked with. For example, one of the ones I worked with in Florida is now in clinical trial for human breast cancer, a treatment of human breast cancer. Yeah, I know, it's quite crazy. And in fact, the compound is derived from a fungus that lives inside the sponge at great depth. These things are only from sort of below 100 metres. I mean, you've got to wonder why, don't you? And I'm not going to venture an answer at this point.
Human nature normally dictates that when something's incredibly rare, there's someone out there who wants, who sort of covets it, wants to collect it, and therefore it becomes extremely valuable. Is that the case with sponges?
Extremely valuable. Well, they're extremely...
Is there some strange person sitting in Russia, some oil baron who would, you know, happily pay $1 million for the only specimen of a particular sponge?
Well, I don't know.
They don't email you much?
No. They don't know about it very often, I guess. That's why I was kind of surprised we got onto this list. But it's kind of a small field. I mean, unless we do things on national, you know, New Zealand Geographic and stuff, people don't really know about it. You know, scientists, we publish a lot in the primary literature, which, of course, you guys never see. So what I'd like to do is I like to try and do things in the public arena, and I'm at present doing a field guide to the sponges of New Zealand, which is virtually all images. So the sort of thing that most people like to look at, pictures.
Now, let's get into the details. Carnivorous sponges, how do they work? How do they eat? Because they don't have stomachs and mouths and things like that, do they?
Well, no sponges have a stomach. No sponges have mouths. What they do is they're sort of hollow, and the hollows are lined with cells which draw a current into the animal. So as that water's drawn in, bits of food, bacteria, bits of carbonate material, are sucked into the sponge and then moved by osmosis, or whatever you want to call it, back into the cells, and from there they're fed back to the other cells. So, and that's the typical sponge model. However, it was discovered, my colleague in France, Jean Vasselet, discovered in, I think it was the 80s, he found these sponges in a cave in France that clearly weren't filtering. In fact, he kept one in a jar for about a year, and it lived. It was quite incredible. And what he did was he sectioned it, and he found out that, in fact, these animals were enzymatically dissolving their prey. So what they would do is they're all like little dandelions, and that one I've brought in is an example of it. What happens is a shrimp might inadvertently come into the realm of the sponge, like, you know, quite close to it, and its little setae, which are like little claws, get caught in the sponge. And what happens is the sponge kind of just gradually moves in and sort of, how would you describe it, sort of engulfs it, like getting tangled in a dandelion. You know, if you touch a dandelion, it sort of crumples. Well, what happens then is the cells very quickly move over the prey and literally digest the material inside the shrimp. And we're talking tiny little things about a millimetre long. And that's how these animals live.
Has this ever been observed? Of course it wouldn't, would it? Because it's all been happening a kilometre under the sea.
Well, no, it has been observed because Jean Vasselet has managed to keep some of these animals alive in his laboratory, actually a little tiny tank, for years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite amazing.
Throwing the odd shrimp in.
Yes, there's been many a sort of amusing article written about him and his sponges.
Do we have any idea of how many different species of sponge there are?
Worldwide, I think the latest reports say that there's about 6,700 described species, but I can tell you there's probably three or four times even more than that. In New Zealand alone, we have probably over 8,000 species, and most of them aren't described.
Well, that field guide's going to be a big book, isn't it?
Common field sponges.
I was going to say, I can imagine being a kilometre underwater with your book sort of flicking through going, no.
No, not that one.
How do you gather sponges from that far down?
Well, these were collected by dredge and by remote operated vehicle. So we do have access to remote operated vehicles.
Remote control submarines, basically.
Yes, yeah.
Because the dredge way of collecting sponges, you're cringing now a little bit. I mean, you are destroying exactly what it is you seek to research, isn't it?
Yes. It's one of the difficult things that we... one of the difficult things in in the identification and sort of biodiversity is that in order to name something, in order to know about it, you've got to find it, you've got to hold it, you've got to look at it. One of the things that we're doing now is we're doing a lot more identification from images. So we're really working hard on getting great cameras that take fabulous photographs underwater. But that's very limited. And I'm probably at the top of my experience in this, and I can probably identify about maybe 50 to 60% of the sponges that are taken that we have images of. But it's not the same as having one in your hand and actually being able to look at it under a microscope.
Well, fantastic. Look, thank you so much for coming in. Good luck, I suppose, in the species awards. And thanks very much for bringing this sponge in for us to look at as well.
You're welcome.
That's Dr. Michelle Kelly from NIWA. If you'd like to find out more about the top 10 species of the year, pop along to species.asu.edu. Coming up after the break, Max Cryer and Ben King.